The following program is brought to you by the volunteers of the Media Center at Seattle First Baptist Church, www.sfbcommunity.org.
Good evening once again, friends. I'd like to take a moment to thank some of our co-sponsors. We're welcomed here tonight by Seattle First Baptist Church and the American Friends Service Committee, the Quakers, who have been in the business of making a peaceful and better world even longer than Seattle First Baptist Church has. Also, the Arab American Community Coalition, the Interfaith Network of Concern for People of Iraq, and the Partners in Peacemaking Group at Seattle First Baptist Church, and also the Western Washington Fellowship of Reconciliation. I'm now going to introduce our partner in setting up this event tonight. She is the Associate Director for the Pacific Northwest Region of the American Friends Service Committee, Nina LaBoy.
Oh, thank you, everyone. Thank you for being here. And I want to especially thank Seattle First Baptist Church and Pastor Tim and Paul and Perry and everyone who helped put this together. It's really the first of I hope, many, many more events that we'll do together. For those of you who don't know, I just want to give a little bit of history of American Friends Service Committee, in that our organization was started by Quakers in 1917, providing alternative service to conscientious objectors in World War I. And since then, we've had hundreds and hundreds of programs, humanitarian, justice, peace-loving programs all over the world, including now in China and Puerto Rico, Rwanda, Jordan, North Korea, Palestine, and we currently have two specific major campaigns in addition to all the campaigns we have all over the world, and one is called the Countdown to Withdrawal, and we're counting the days that President Obama has said that he will withdraw from Iraq, and trying to keep him to the letter. And the other is our Cost of War campaign, and it's an education campaign and letting people know how much money is spent daily on the cost of the war that the United States taxpayers and our cities are paying day by day, which could probably, if they cut all of that funding away from the wars and Department of Defense, would really help our recession to a great deal. We now spend more than half of our United States budget on defense and war. For here in the Pacific Northwest, our office opened in 1942, helping the Japanese who were being interned. And we continue to this day having programs, and right, our regional office in Seattle has a program, an Indian program, where we work with natives from all over the Pacific Northwest. We have a community justice program that works in the prisons system, and we have a freedom school every year based after the freedom schools in the 1960s, and we have a gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered justice program. That is working, and I do peace work on peace issues and rallies and events like this and guest speakers, and so that's what we're doing here in Seattle. In our Portland office there, we have a big force that is working on immigration issues, on immigrants' rights, and with youth. And so if you're so inclined to do this work, we need a lot of resources, and if you're so inclined and like to give a donation, you can give it at our table in the back of the room, and we would really appreciate that. And Now to our speaker. I worked in New York City for about 10 or 12 years in a community organization that worked in the grassroots and did environmental justice work and did organizing around different issues, education reform. We also did some anti-war work and some political action work. But one of the most important things that I learned in doing that social justice work was that the people who are experiencing oppression are the experts in what they need. And I think that our speaker, Ray Gerard, is going to speak to that today for the people of Iraq. And Ra'ed.
Well, thank you everyone for coming, and thanks for the Seattle First Baptist Church for giving us the space as well. I've been working with the American Friends Service Committee for the last few years now, since I moved to the U.S. And most of my work is to try to bring the Iraqi narrative of what has been happening in Iraq to the U.S. audience. Because unfortunately, what we hear in the media here in the U.S. is a complete different story from what Iraqis think or what Iraqis hear or what they believe is the history and present and the future of their country. Now, the story that we've been hearing about Iraq here, unfortunately, it's not a very happy story, and it changes a lot. Now, in the last 19 years of war, since the war between the U.S. and Iraq started in 1990 or 1991, there have been a lot of different stories given to justify this continuing war and occupation. So towards the beginning of the war in 1990 and 1991, the reasons given to justify the U.S. Bombing of Iraq and sending troops to the region, reasons were more about saving Kuwait or liberating Kuwait from the Iraqi occupation. After that, after 1991, the reasons shifted to saving Iraqis from their own government. And then after that, it became saving Iraqis from other Iraqis. And this shifts, of course, all the time. One time it's saving the Sunnis from Shiites. One time it's saving Shiites from Sunnis. One time it's saving Kurds from Arabs, and one time it's saving Kurds from other Kurds. There are always shifting targets, right? I mean, I can go on and on to list the excuses given to justify the ongoing, almost daily bombing and ongoing sanctions during the 90s. Maybe that will take us a few hours. You know, some of the excuses were so ridiculous. I remember at one moment they said, the U.S. government said, we have to search Saddam Hussein's bedrooms because maybe he's hiding a nuclear bomb under his bed or something. At some other moment they said, we have to continue the sanctions because we're worried about some endangered bird species in the marshes of Iraq, in the south. So, I mean, like infinity number of reasons. But whenever an excuse is debunked or proven to be a lie, the U.S. government moved to the next one without any examination of what happened last week, unfortunately followed by the mainstream media as well. Now, I'm sure most of you are familiar with the excuses given to justify the 2003 invasion. The U.S. public were told, and the world public were told, that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. They said Iraq has this one weapon of mass destruction that a drop of it can melt your body or something, you know. They said Iraq can destroy, you know, entire parts of the world in 30 minutes if they put these powerful weapons together. Now, we know that Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction as well, but then many people knew that Iraq didn't have weapons of mass destruction. It's not like people believe these lies. You know, Iraqis like myself who were in Iraq, we saw the United Nations inspection teams going around our neighborhoods for 13 years, you know? And I saw them a couple of times in my neighborhood and a couple of times in my university, in the University of Baghdad. People knew that Iraq did not have weapons, let alone weapons of mass destruction. You know, Iraq didn't have enough weapons to from the conventional weapons or missiles, let alone nuclear missiles. Now, the other excuse was that Iraq had a link with Al-Qaeda, and everyone at that time said that will never happen. How would an extremely secular, anti-religious, Arab nationalist regime like the Iraqi one collaborate with an religious Islamic organization that is, Al-Qaeda considers the Iraqi government as big as an enemy as they consider the U.S. government, you know. Why would they collaborate, you know? So now, of course, we know that these things were all lies, you know, because they were debunked. And the millions of people who marched, and I'm sure that many of you in this room did march in February of 2003, to say we don't believe your lies and we don't want this occupation and this war to take place. People knew that these were lies. Now, of course, after that, more excuses given to justify continuing the same exact policy of bombing and intervention. And they said we have to be in Iraq to capture Saddam Hussein. We have to be there to fight the Ba'athists. We have to be there to fight insurgents who are crossing from Syria. We have to be there to start some reconstruction, to make a better record for human rights, to bring democracy, to, you know, all of these things, right? We forgot many of them. But until now, there are some people who try to come up with more excuses to justify the same old policy. More excuses. Despite the fact that we are in a complete different political moment. Now, in 2009, now we are going through a completely different situation compared to how the situation looked like last year. Last year, I visited Seattle, and I can recognize some faces in the audience who actually came last year. Last year, the situation was different. I came here and I said the Bush administration is planning to continue the occupation for the next 50 years. This was the plan. Now we have a complete different situation. Now we have a bilateral agreement that was signed between Iraq and the U.S. Later last year. And that bilateral agreement, despite all of the attempts of the Bush administration, ended up containing a deadline. It included a deadline for all troop withdrawal. All U.S. forces shall withdraw from all Iraqi territories by December 31st, 2011. This is the end game of this agreement. And this agreement, of course, was not put just by the Bush administration. The Bush administration tried their best to reach to a permanent basis agreement. They failed because the American public did a lot of work and the Iraqi public did a lot of work. And the last battle was the Iraqi parliament. The Iraqi parliament managed to pressure the executive branches to include that deadline for all troop withdrawal. And the Obama administration, too. The agreement actually was signed during the transitional period, so the Obama administration did have some say in it. So now, in 2009, we have a bilateral agreement that requires all U.S. troops to withdraw from Iraq completely by the end of 2011. It has a couple of other benchmarks within this bigger timetable for all troop withdrawal. Like, for example, all U.S. Combat forces must withdraw from all Iraqi cities and towns and villages by June 30th of this year. So we're talking about, you know, a few weeks from now. And this is happening. The U.S. is withdrawing from all posts in cities and towns and villages to bases outside the cities and towns and villages. And this is a good development in the sense of Iraqis not seeing occupation troops on a daily basis. The other benchmark that was not included in the agreement per se, but it was announced by President Obama during his very important speech in February 27th of this year in Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. He detailed the plan with all of the numbers. Now, in that speech, he said that combat troops will be withdrawn from Iraq by August of 2010, which will bring the number of U.S. troops in Iraq to between 30 and 50,000 instead of the current 140,000. And those 30,000 will be withdrawn completely by the end of 2011. So by January 1st of 2012, the current agreement and the current presidential plan in the U.S. that Iraq will not have any U.S. soldiers, any U.S. contractors, or any U.S. bases or posts. Zero. Not one. Not just like a little base with some engineers in it. Just a small post with nice soldiers in it. Nothing. Like, there is no way to actually change the agreement without going through the Iraqi parliament again. Well, now, despite the fact that we do have this agreement now that requires all the U.S. troops to withdraw, this doesn't mean that the war is over. We still have, as of today, we have 130,000 U.S. troops, 140,000 U.S. contractors, and other few thousands of coalition forces that are on their way out. There are six of the countries, you know, the coalition of the willing. Like Britain has a few hundreds. Macedonia has maybe six soldiers or something. So the remains of the coalition of the willing are withdrawing as well. Despite this, what we are going through now is actually a major political victory for anyone who worked to end the war with Iraq. Anyone who worked during the last 19 years of war and occupation and sanctions and bombings and intervention, this is a huge political victory. Because we are not in a place where we have a president or an agreement that is going to turn the current occupation to an occupation light. You know, it's not just going to enhance the occupation. No, it's going to end it for real. This is the political agreement. Now, of course, there is a lot of work to be done to make sure that this political agreement will become reality. We haven't even started implementing yet. We're talking about an agreement that is 1,000 days long, and we went, I think, so far maybe in 100 days out of the 1,000 days. So we still have 90%. The harder 90% is still, you know, on its way. Now, there are many people who want to sabotage the withdrawal agreement. People who are not happy with ending the occupation, but not people who are like us. Not people who go to public speaking events and ask for demonstrations in the street. No, like more powerful people who can, you know, send car bombs and assassinate some leaders, but they don't have enough power to actually put a million people in the street. So very powerful special interest groups in the U.S. are not happy with ending the occupation. This will make their weapon sales less. This will make their whatever their special interest is harmed. Many people in the region as well, some regional powers, some Al-Qaeda, for example, and some regional organizations are not happy with ending the occupation. This will actually remove one of their best recruiting tools, one of their best reasons to exist. Of course, they are not happy with that. So now, after 19 years of excuses to justify war and occupation, now we have a new main excuse to justify prolonging the occupation a little bit longer. You know, we shouldn't finish it in 2 or 3 years. Let's stay just for another 5 years. So the new myth that has been circulating in the last few months or the last few years is that we should not withdraw from Iraq. This is what the media and some politicians are telling us now. We should not withdraw from Iraq, not because we are evil imperialists who want to kill them or anything. We should not withdraw because we love them. We love them so much that we can't leave them to kill each other. If we withdraw from Iraq, the sky will fall on them, and then Iraqis, the Sunni Iraqis, will have fights with the Shiite Iraqis, and they will kill each other's babies in the street, and it will just be the end of the world. So we have to be there to protect those savage people from each other. This is what I hear on the media, and when I say the media, I don't just mean Fox News. I mean from Fox News until NPR. Wherever I hear the media, people say, the Sunnis hate the Shiites, right? Muslims are just crazy. They blow themselves up because they get 72 virgins in heaven. This is what we get told, right? Which, by the way, I've never heard about this 72 virgin thing before. And I don't know why having 72 wives would be heaven. But I assure you that there aren't many people who know this outside the U.S. It's one of these things that we just hear here. Now, let me talk a little bit about, debunk this myth that what's happening now in Iraq is a sectarian and religious conflict based on ancient hatred. And if we withdraw, a genocide will take place. So we have to be there because it is our responsibility as Americans to protect Iraqis from the dangers of their, you know, neighbors or other Iraqis who might kill them. Let me debunk this. But before I start talking about it, there is no reason for us to believe another lie from the same analysts and from the same politicians who have been lying for 19 years. You know, they didn't change. They're the same ones. And I assure you that they didn't wake up one morning with conscience now. They're just saying these things because it's a good way to sell continuing the same exact policy of intervention and politics and bombings and killings that will get them some of the benefits that they want. They don't really care about Iraqis. They don't really care about Iranian women when they say, let's go liberate Iranian women. They use that as an excuse, right? They don't really care about what's happening in other parts of the world, but they use these things to manipulate the U.S. public opinion. Because they know that many Americans feel responsible of what has been happening in Iraq, and they try to manipulate that to get Americans to say, okay, let's stay for another couple of years if that's better for Iraqis. Now, the major myth about this humanitarian intervention is based on a story that we've been hearing for the last years, that the conflict inside Iraq is a religious and sectarian conflict, right? This is what we hear. There is this thing called the Sunnis, one group of people, who fight against another group of people called the Shiites, and there is a third group called the Kurds. And there are some Christians, you know, running around between these three groups. Now, this is an analysis of the conflict. This analysis of the conflict is actually widely rejected by most Iraqis. Iraqis do not believe that what's happening now, what has been happening in Iraq, is a sectarian or religious conflict. They don't believe that. They don't believe that they woke up one morning in 2003 and started killing each other. You know, this is not the way that the Iraqi public view the conflict. So let me talk a little bit about that. Now, number one, the Iraqi public think that there is a foreign occupation that has to do something. You know, the U.S. Tank in the street is a part of the current conflict, unlike what the U.S. media tries to tell us, that, you know, look at these people dying and then there is nothing about our presence there. No, and from an Iraqi point of view, there is something about the U.S. presence. The U.S. did destroy the Iraqi structures and governing structures, and the U.S. has, until this day, a direct responsibility, and the U.S. is a direct cause for a lot of the violence and a lot of the distress or unrest that happens in Iraq. Now, in addition to that, Iraqis believe that there is an Iraqi conflict that has been going on. There is some Iraqi-Iraqi conflict, right? Some Iraqis fighting against each other. But not because of sectarian or religious reasons, but the conflict is, from an Iraqi point of view, is more about political and economic differences. So there are some Sunnis who have a conflict with other Sunnis, some Shiites with other Shiites, some Kurds with other Kurds, some Christians with other Christians, some seculars with other seculars, and so on. Some Turkmen with other Turkmen, some Mandaeans with other Mandaeans, Baha'is. Iraq has an infinity number of backgrounds and sects and small groups, right? Now, the Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds who have similar political and economic ideologies are united against other Sunnis and other Shiites and other Kurds who have similar ideologies as well. So you see the conflict? It's not Sunnis killing Shiites. It's more about Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds, on the one hand, having a conflict with other Sunnis and other Shiites and other Kurds. Now, the three reasons that divide the Iraqi public, regardless of their sectarian or religious background, are, number one, what do they think about the central government? There is a minority of Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds who have been allied with the Bush administration, who want to weaken the central government and strengthen regional governments. So, I mean, in a U.S. context, imagine how the U.S. Civil War had that component. It was a major component in the U.S. Civil War. Those who wanted to keep the powers within Washington, D.C. and the central government, and those who wanted to have the powers within the states and the regional governments or local governments. The same conflict in Iraq is amplified so many times. There are so many Iraqis who believe that that's actually the biggest internal conflict. Now, the second conflict that has been putting Iraqis against each other is the issue of natural resources. The Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds allied with the Bush administration they tend to be supportive of privatizing Iraq's oil, giving it to multinational oil companies and taking, you know, a percentage of what the profits are. The other Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds who were not allied with the Bush administration, who represent the majority of Iraqis, are for keeping the Iraqi natural resources, gas and oil, owned by the government. This is how the situation is now. They are all nationalized, owned by the government. And the third and maybe most important one is that the Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds who were allied with the Bush administration are okay with foreign interventions. They are okay with the U.S. occupation to continue for a few decades. They are okay with the Iranian intervention and the Iranian role in Iraq to continue for a few decades. They're okay with Saudi Arabia interfering, okay with so many different regional powers to interfere, because they don't have enough capacity by themselves to run the country, so they need some foreign support to run the country. The other Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds are the ones who are against any foreign intervention, whether it's from the US or Iran or Al-Qaeda or Saudi Arabia or whomever. Now, this conflict is not religious. There is nothing in the Quran or the Bible about how to decide our territorial integrity. You know, there is nothing in the Quran or Bible or any other religious texts about natural resources and oil and right, or foreign intervention. These are earthly fights between politicians, right? They're not ancient hatred that is putting Iraqis to kill each other. These are modern political problems about nation states. Now, here comes one of the biggest differences in perception, in understanding the conflict from an Iraqi point of view compared to the U.S. point of view. Iraqis don't think that the U.S. is a peacekeeping force protecting them from their neighbors. You know, this is not what the vast majority of Iraqis, and we're talking about numbers that are not just more than 3/4, sometimes it's more than 9 out of 10. People view the U.S. as a foreign occupier. It's a foreign invader that has been taking sides within the internal conflict. Imagine if we had, you know, 10 million Chinese soldiers occupying the U.S. during the American Civil War, taking the side of the South against the Union, you know, bombing the central government, or taking the side of the Union against the South. That would be a completely different war, right? It will not be the same war that we're talking about now. Now, this is how Iraqis view the U.S. presence. It's a part of the problem. It's a part of the problem that started violence, and it's a part of the problem that continues violence, the problem that continues to prop up a minority of Iraqis who are Sunnis or Shiites or Kurds or whatever against the will of the majority of Iraqis, whether they were Sunnis or Shiites or Kurds. So that's why I think understanding the conflict and analyzing the conflict from an Iraqi point of view will make us understand from here why the majority of Iraqis want the U.S. out. They're not suicidal, right? If they really thought that a genocide will erupt, they wouldn't say, leave our country alone. So these are two very important points to think about Iraq. One of them is that Iraqis do not want us there. There are so many public opinion polls that I suggest you visit. There is a website, the Brookings Institute's website, actually compiles all of the public opinion polls that are conducted in Iraq, whether they are local or regional or international. It's called the Iraq Index. They put it in this one. So if you go to the Iraq Index, you will go through these dozens and dozens of public opinion polls that were conducted in Iraq in the last few years. None of them says, please stay in our country, you know? Now, in addition to Iraq is not wanting us, Iraq is not wanting us there. The point that I want to talk about more today and stress more is that Iraqis do not need us there. You know, Iraqis don't need us to babysit them and protect them from their cousins or anything. This is not true. These things do not happen in real life, you know? I assure you that I haven't met a lot of Iraqis who are worried about a lack of a foreign occupation. You know, seriously, I mean, it doesn't happen that way. Like, people don't freak out about what would they do with their own independent and sovereign nation, you know? Like, how would they manage that disaster, you know? It doesn't happen that way. Iraqis are worried about the continuation of the occupation. Now, when you look at Iraq's history, you know, it has a long history, of course. It goes back maybe 6,000 or 7,000 years from the time of the Mesopotamia and the civilizations that existed then. This is who Iraqis think they are, the descendants of Ur and Ashur and Babylon and right, all of these old civilizations that existed 6,000 or 7,000 years ago. And this is not just like a urban myth or something. It's true. People have been living continuously in Iraq, all of these times, you know? Like, no one shipped Iraqis to Iraq a few hundred years ago, or like... Now, in the last 1300 years, since the creation of Baghdad, Baghdad was created overnight as a capital to the Islamic empire. Actually, they decided the location of Baghdad, and they made it a circular city. It's one of the very few circular cities at that part, at that time of history. They put a rope that is around a mile or 2 miles long in one place, and gave the edge of the rope to a man on a horse. And he went around with his sword and made a big circle around. And then they filled the circle with oil and lit it, and called the Khalifa, the head of the state. And they told him, this is where Baghdad will be. And he said, okay. So they built the city there. Now, since Baghdad was built, 1,246 years ago, it was occupied before. This is not the first occupation. Cities and countries in that part of the world are actually it's highly contested, you know. So Iraq occupies Iran, Iran occupies Iraq, Egypt occupies Antonum. It's like it happens all the time. So Baghdad fell under occupation 20 different times in the last 13 centuries. Some of the occupations lasted, you know, a few weeks. Some of them lasted 300 years, like the Ottoman occupation. Now, there is no one precedent where, after the foreign invaders left, the sky fell on Iraqis. It never happened before. It always happened this way, where when Iraq was under occupations, the sky did fall every day. It did fall every day. We're talking about 6 years of an occupation that has killed 1 million Iraqis. I mean, imagine the impact. 1 million Iraqis were killed in the last 6 years. Just imagine how huge the number is. And 5 million Iraqis were displaced. They had to leave their homes. We're talking about a country with where almost one out of every five or one out of every four Iraqis were either killed or injured or displaced in the last 5 or 6 years alone. So, I mean, the price has been really heavy, you know. And the price has been heavy for Iraqis and for Americans, even when we talk about the price of the war from this side, in addition to the thousands of soldiers that were killed and injured. The U.S. taxpayers continue to pay $720 million a day to continue the occupation. $720 million. It actually breaks down to $500,000 a minute. So imagine, from the time that I started talking until now, we spent like $20 million in Iraq. So imagine how much money is being wasted on this occupation and war. It's really painful. Now, before I finish to take some of your questions and comments, or like if you had any stories that you want to share, let me just talk about one last point, which is there are so many specificities on why Iraqis hate this occupation. In fact, you know, I talked about them today, and I debunked the myths and, you know, like tried to talk about more specific things to Iraq. But at the same time, there are some things that are more universal. All humans have universal things, right? So, for example, if someone came today to your church, and like, let's say Dick Cheney came to your church and said, torture, actually, in Iraq is cool. It's fine to torture Iraqis because it's a part of their culture. And it's good for our country to torture Iraqis. Would we need to ask an Iraqi if they like to be tortured or not? We don't, right? It's not like when they put the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, they went around and they asked Iraqis, do you like to be tortured? Okay, Iraqis don't like torture. What about Afghanis? Do you like to be tortured? Okay, they don't like torture either, right? It doesn't happen that way. So we don't have the need. We don't have, in the U.S., there is no mentality to buy any argument that justifies torture. Let's hope. This is my hope. Now, slavery. Do we have to ask Iraqis if they like to be enslaved? Do we need some Iraqi to come to your church and tell you, actually, in our culture, we like freedom. We don't like slavery. We don't. Well, that's actually new. 200 years ago in the U.S., people did argue that Africans were better off as slaves because they're not civilized enough to take care of themselves. You know, these poor Africans, let's enslave them to make them humans, to civilize them and give them a better life. They're living in, they die, they starve to death. Let's actually enslave them. That's good for them. This is what they said a couple of hundred years ago. And they said, let's enslave Africans because that's good for our economy. It's good for us to enslave them. Now, if someone said these things today, even if they brought 10 native informants, and the 10 of them said, we love slavery, actually, we will still say no to slavery because we don't have a mentality in the U.S. that recognizes or justifies slavery. But unfortunately, we still have a mentality in the U.S. that does recognize and does justify occupations until this day. So that's why if we actually change this mentality, if we had a new mentality that says occupations are wrong, we should not go invade other nations and tell them what to do with their country. People actually know how to take care of themselves, the same way that we know how to take care of our nation here in the U.S., the same way that we would freak out if a Russian tank rolled down our streets here. Other people don't like occupations. So the mentality, I think, the mentality that is behind justifying occupations must be dealt with. It's not just an issue of information. It's not just an issue of how can we reach to the more accurate information that proves to us that Iraqis don't like occupation. It's more about us believing that occupations are wrong and we should not be interfering in other nations. And there is no such a thing as a foreign military occupation led by us that is liberating others or saving them from their cousins or making their country a little bit better. If we drop that mentality, I think things will be easier to deal with. Let me stop here and take some of your questions and comments. Well, what I mentioned were the excuses given by the government to justify the invasion. I haven't talked about what I think the real reasons are, because when it comes to the real reasons, I will be speculating, right? What I was talking about are documented information that we can go back and Google it and find it, right? Now, the question about why have we been in a state of war with Iraq for the last 19 years is a very valid question, and we should be asking it to our representatives every day. Why are we in Iraq? What's the reason now? Like, how come we had 200 different reasons in the last couple of decades? So that's a question to ask our representatives. I will speculate now to say, I would assume that if Iraq's major export item was tomatoes, not oil, that Iraq wouldn't have been invaded. You know, I assume that oil has something to do with it. The fact that Iraq is the second biggest oil reserve on Earth had something to do with it. I would assume that some parts of the U.S. government, the national security establishment, the so-called national security establishment inside the U.S. government, the permanent government inside the U.S. government, you know, the NSA and CIA and the State Department and all of these people who don't get changed with elections, but they want a military base in Iraq, in the Middle East, a permanent base. They looked at the world map and they said, here, they want one. I would argue that. I haven't seen them do that, though. I would argue that many of the special interest groups pushed for that, whether it's maybe the pro-Israel lobby or the weapons lobby or, you know, whatever other lobbies, the big companies that benefited from this war. So there are many things that I would argue that it had to do with the real reasons that were not shared with us. You know, we haven't seen any U.S. official actually tell us about the real reasons why we go to war. They always tell us about some excuses that will justify prolonging the occupation and stuff. Now, oil, of course, was one of the major main battles that Iraqis had to fight against the U.S. plans. So the major plan was to privatize Iraq's oil through a new oil law that was written by a State Department contractor. The State Department contracted a company called Bearing Point, based in the Washington, D.C. area. And the contract is publicly available, actually, because someone who I know asked for the contract in FOIA, in a Freedom of Information Act. So the contract is out there. You know, it's not like a conspiracy or anything. The contract between the State Department and Bearing Point, one of the major things that Bearing Point was supposed to do is to rewrite the Iraqi oil laws. So they rewrote the Iraqi oil laws. They wrote this huge oil law. Some of the experts call it an oil regime, not an oil law, because it has so many different laws inside it. And I actually helped leak and translate that law to English during the big battle that, you know, political battle that took place at that time, 2 or 3 years ago. Now, that law tried to privatize Iraq's natural resources through passing a very unconventional type of contracting called PSA, Production Sharing Agreement. It's very unconventional. I think 5% of the oil revenue in the world gets produced under PSAs. In, for example, an island in the middle of the ocean that they don't really, they're not sure that there is oil there. So they get a company to go there and they tell them, you know what, search. If you find any oil, it's yours and give us 20%, you know. But Iraq is the second biggest oil reserve. You know, everyone knows that we have oil there. That's a problem, actually, that everyone knows. So the PSAs were tried to pass PSAs, and the worst type of PSAs, up to 37 years of PSAs. Imagine the level of you know, like corruption and how huge the plan is to privatize Iraq's oil from now until, you know, 2050 or something, you know. Now, the second thing that it tried to decentralize the oil production and oil contracting process to support those separatists, the Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds, who are not happy with having a strong central government. So by giving them their own oil to sell it by themselves without going through the central government, and many other points. Now, that oil law failed a couple of years ago. It was stopped by the Iraqi parliament, and the Iraqi parliament sent the oil law to the equivalent of the Supreme Court in Iraq, Majlis al-Shura, al-Shura Council, and then that's it. So that oil, that law did not go anywhere because the Supreme Court upheld what the Iraqi parliament said, the points that the Iraqi parliament put. So there haven't been any news about a new oil law since, and I think no news is good news. Yes, but these, so the new contracts that are being signed are TSAs, the technical service agreements, the ones that do not privatize the Iraqi oil. They just give a flat rate contract to an oil company to dig a well or build a refinery or whatever. And of course, they are stealing maybe tens or hundreds of millions of dollars through these TSAs, but it's not as big as a destruction for Iraq's future as the previous one. So it's their plan B, I guess. And,
Speak up.
I'll repeat the question. No problem.
To most Iraqis, do you think they do they have much faith in the new government that the United States had such a big role in creating, or do they see it as sort of a puppet that they don't respect?
Do most Iraqis have enough faith in the new government, the Iraqi government, or do they think of it as a puppet government that the U.S. Installed? That's an excellent question. We're going through a transitional period now in the last few months. I think psychologically people are going through a transitional period. In the last 6 years, Iraq did not have a functioning Iraqi government. And this was actually the main excuse given by the Bush administration. The Bush administration said, you know, we would love to withdraw, but we can't stand down until Iraqis stand up. And then Iraqis never stood up because their government was weak and dysfunctional. Now, the Iraqi government, of course, has a crisis, obviously. It's a dysfunctioning, weak, unpopular government. It has a crisis. But the crisis is not a crisis of equipment or a crisis of resources or a crisis of, you know, support from outside or UN recognition or anything. It's a crisis of domestic legitimacy. There is no the Iraqis don't think that this government is legitimate. They think of it as a puppet government. Now, this is not a surprise, right? Because this is very similar to, for example, how the French viewed the government installed by the Nazis during World War II. You know, they didn't think this is our government, let's go help it. And they thought, who are these people who are, you know, running our country now, these Nazi supporters, puppets, right? Now, many people, including myself, have been arguing in the last few years that what the Bush administration is saying, once Iraqis stand up, we will stand down, will never happen, because Iraqis will never stand up. This Iraqi government will never stand up until the U.S. leaves. It will happen the other way around. We will never have a government in Iraq that is viewed as a legitimate government, that Iraqis think of it as a national government that represents their interests under a foreign occupation. It will not happen. Now, since the announcement of the bilateral agreement between the two countries, I think the Iraqi political process had a good boost. Many people now are thinking, oh, you know what? It seems like the Americans are actually really leaving, and maybe we should participate more in this political process. So the elections that happened in January of this year, there were provincial elections that took place. And these provincial elections showed that the majority of the public voted for those parties who are against the occupation, the ones who tend to be more nationalist, regardless of their sect or background, and voted less for those parties who are separatists or okay with the occupation. Those who support the occupation lost miserably, actually. They got maybe 10 or 15% of the votes instead of winning the councils. So there are some good signs, I think good signs of hope, that those Iraqis who did run on a platform of opposing the occupation won the elections lately, and they might be winning the major elections next March, the parliamentary elections that should take place last March. Now, there is a minority of Iraqis who still think that the entire political process is illegitimate because it's under an occupation. I completely understand that, but there aren't many Iraqis who believe that. You know, the biggest proportion of the public and the biggest proportion of the most of the Iraqi political leaders are participating in the political process. Now, the vast majority of them are just in the legislative branch, in the parliament, because that's the only elected part of the government in Iraq. They are excluded from the selected parts, like the executive branch. You know, we don't have any nationalists in the executive branch or from the judicial branch, they are excluded. But in the legislative branch, in the parliament, I think they are more represented there. And most of the different Iraqi factions, political and military factions, are represented there. So I think the bottom line, the short answer, is that after the U.S. leaves Iraq, Iraq will have a government that is legitimate and that is does represent the Iraqi public. Now, whether that government is exactly the same as this one, or whether it's modified, or whether it's completely different, that's a question to ask, you know. I think it will be a modified version of the current government. Many of the people who came on the U.S. tanks will run away after the U.S. tanks leave. They will go back to Tehran, and London and Washington, D.C., unfortunately, where I live. So I have to see them all the time. But they will not be there. Many people who are actually, you know, want to be in Iraq, they can express their political views within the Iraqi political process. So it seems like we are heading towards that direction now. It seems like things are finally getting on the right path. There are so many things to enhance, like, you know, one article here to tweak, some article here to edit. But more or less, in Iraq, we need some enhancements for a good plan, a plan that did put Iraq on the right path finally. But compare this to what's happening in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is a disaster. A disaster. Sending more troops, justifying more killings. Yesterday, the U.S. military killed 100 civilians in one raid. More of that, you know, more of the same rhetoric. Afghanistan is not on the right track that we can, you know, enhance a little bit here and there. That's on the wrong track, you know, completely. We have to take that train off that track, put it on another track, and then start enhancing it. So I think with Iraq, the situation is better. But, as I said earlier, the war is not over yet. We still have 140,000 troops, 140,000 contractors, and we have a lot of powerful people in the U.S. and in the region and in Iraq who are benefiting from the occupation, who will try their best in the next 1,000 days to sabotage the plans of ending the occupation.
Do you see something about the Kurdish issue or the Kurdish separatism, or are they being invited into and participating in the central government?
Yes. Am I seeing any signs that Kurdish separatists are more willing to participate in the central government? Yes. Not mainly because they were invited to participate in the central government, mainly because the two ruling parties in the Kurdish area in Iraq, in the north of Iraq, discovered their limitations, the ceiling of what they can ask for during the last 6 years. Now, the Kurdish region in Iraq had its special status from 1963, you know, for a long time. The Kurdish region had self-autonomy. Now, sometimes that self-autonomy was functioning in a good way. Sometimes it was crushed by the central government, and the central government started running the Kurdish region directly. And sometimes they went to an extreme. They were functioning as a separate government completely, a separate country between 1991 and 2003. They tried different things. Now, the conclusion of trying all of the extents, I think now, is that the two ruling parties in Kurdistan, the PUK and KDP, who tend to be more separatist than the Kurdish public and way more separatist than the Iraqi public's mood, it seems that they have been more accepting to the idea of continuing to be in Iraq. Now, one of the very good indicators is what happened a couple of months ago when the Turkish president visited Iraq. This was the first time any Turkish presidents visit Iraq in 33 years, you know, a long time. Now, the Turkish president visited Iraq, and he met with the Iraqi president, who is Talibani. He's the head of one of the two ruling Kurdish parties. He's a Kurd himself. And in that meeting, the Iraqi president, the Iraqi Kurdish president, announced that he condemns any attempts by Kurds to secede from Iraq, or secede from Turkey, or secede from Iran. He condemns any attempts of Kurds to destroy the territorial integrity of Iraq or Syria or Iran or Turkey. And he promised that he thinks that Kurds must work within the current framework of nation states. So they will work as Iraqi Kurds and Turkish Kurds and Iranian Kurds and Syrian Kurds, rather than secede from their nations and create their own Kurdish nation that is not linked to the other nation states. So I think they realize the ceilings of what they can do and what can be done. And I think What will end up happening is that we will have a self-autonomous region in Iraq in the north for the three provinces that are ruled now by the two Kurdish parties. And some negotiations will be going down the way of how many authorities does the center have and how many authorities the region has.
Thank you, Kaim, for your work and for being here, and to Nina and the AFSC for making this possible. I have two questions. One, I'm curious, can you tell us a little bit more about who the economic minority are that are in support of maintaining the U.S. occupation? And then secondly, for us, given your experience, if you have any suggestions you can offer on how we can both assure that the deadline is met and assure that our troops under Obama don't simply get transferred to Afghanistan at this point.
Thank you for the question. Those Iraqis who are for privatizing the Iraqi natural resources, I mentioned that they tend to be the more separatist kinds who were allied with the Bush administration. There are four parties who are a part of that agenda. From the Shiite side, there are the Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, a party that came from Iran. There is a party called the Islamic Party, which is a Sunni party that came from Britain. And the two Kurdish parties, the PUK and KDP, that are still participating in the central government until this day, they prefer to have privatized oil and natural resources. And, of course, it's an issue of tension inside Iraq. The vast majority of Iraqis prefer to continue the long heritage of socialist government in Iraq, big government that provides its people by free healthcare and free education and free many other things. Many Iraqis, including myself and my parents, studied in the Iraqi universities for free, and we went to Iraqi hospitals for free. And Iraqis like these things not because they were not invented by one person. They were not invented by Saddam or the president before or the president before. These are Iraqi things that Iraqis created for their country, and they were inherited by many presidents until the last one, of course. And now, what can we do during the next 3 years? There is a lot to be done. There is a lot of supervision and oversight by the public to be done. There is a website that AFSC started a project. We have a website for that project. Nina mentioned earlier. It's the countdowntowithdrawal.org. And on the countdown to withdrawal, we track how many U.S. soldiers are in Iraq now, how many U.S. contractors are in Iraq now, how many U.S. bases are in Iraq now, and what is that? How is this developing with time? Are we following the timeline that was promised, or is it more, or is it less? That's one idea, one thing. You can actually go there and sign up for once a month action alert, just like to keep track of what's happening in that regard. But if there is one thing that I would recommend, I would recommend to focus on one thing from now until the end of 2011, it will be it won't be to go to Iraq and build Iraqi bridges, for example. And it will not be to go to Iraq and teach Iraqis English or teach them democracy or reconcile them or anything. They have enough people who know how to reconcile them who happen to speak Arabic and Kurdish. And they have enough architects and enough people who can work on these things. So my recommendation would be that from now until the end of 2011, that we put all of our pressure to make sure that the last U.S. soldier leaves before the end of 2011, that we will get out of the way and let Iraqis start doing things that they can do and they want to do and they will do for their own nation. So how to stop ourselves as people and our movement as a movement that was against the war all along, falling in that slippery slope of saying, oh, maybe we should stay for another couple of years. Maybe a couple of years of more occupation will be good for Iraqis. Maybe they're not ready yet to withdraw. That's the most dangerous slippery slope within the next couple of years. So how to completely reach to understanding that what the military occupation has caused will never be fixed by prolonging it. It will never happen that way. It will happen by first ending the military occupation completely. And while we're doing that, we think about ideas of building cultural relations and reaching out to Iraqis to help them help themselves, whatever other ideas, you know. I hope next year or the year after when I come back to Seattle, we'll be in a different place where we'll be talking about that. We'll be talking about, now that we have all of our troops out of Iraq, what can we do now? How can we work on the U.S.-Iraqi reconciliation? How can we work on fulfilling our responsibilities as taxpayers who paid for the destruction of Iraq? How can we work on it now? But before we do this, we have to make sure that the last U.S. soldier leaves before the end of 2011. So there are many things that must be done. If you sign up for that email, I think we will be contacting you every month. Like, for example, contacting your representatives or the State Department to ask or inquire about some issues of the agreement, or to try to find what to do with the U.S. embassy. We have the biggest embassy in the history of mankind in Iraq. It's as big as the Vatican, the U.S. embassy. What is that going to be doing in Iraq? You know, are we going to turn it into an American university? That's a good idea. Or are we going to hand it over to the Iraqi side? So there are many things that must be done between now and there. But I think the major issue is to ensure that the occupation is over. Yeah.
I thought the idea of this countdown of that it was President Obama had said we would be out in 16 months. It's been extended. But so that would be May 20th of next year. And so every 20th of every month, you get an action alert.
Yeah.
And the idea is that you then send emails to your congresspeople and
yes.
Say, okay, one less month, so many days. They have a countdown of the day.
Yes.
What's happening? What are you doing? You know, I think that we need to push the momentum.
Of course.
And I think that site, I don't know who designs it, could be more user-friendly for us. Lazy people like me.
Yes.
Could say, okay, McDermott needs to hear on this issue, or
yeah.
Whatever. So it's easier.
Yeah, we are in the process of the website. How it looks now, this is just the beginning of it. So there are so many. The major components are still under construction. Whether it's the main tracker of troop level now versus where troop level should be, that's like a big. We've been working on it for 2 months now. Issues about writing your zip code and knowing exactly what issues you can target your representatives. I mean, we are heading there, but it will take us maybe a few more weeks.
See, we're bombarded every week, almost every day, with the news that the Shia and the Sunnis are killing each other, attacking in wedding parties. And since it's been a long heritage of our covert intelligence department to be provocateurs and hire mercenary murderers to pit people against each other, what can be done to intervene on some of these stories, or at least allude to the fact that there are mercenaries hired, given huge sums of money to do some of these things? Is there anything in the Quran, for instance, that would allow much less prompt one group to blow up the others, religious?
There are. But, you know, the same way that you are trying to find something in the Quran about, like some useful phrase or verse, there are many people in Iraq who are trying to do it, who read it and try to find, ways to deal with these attacks. Now, most of the attacks that happen in Iraq, there are so many attacks. We're not talking about a country that is safe or stable. We're talking about a country that went through one of the biggest ethnic and sectarian cleansing campaigns in the history of the region. Since the creation of Israel in 1948, there haven't been ethnic and sectarian cleansing campaigns as big as the one that happened in Iraq during the last 6 years alone. Now, the ethnic and sectarian cleansing campaign that took place in Iraq was not religious, as I explained. It was more political. So let me give you a more detailed explanation about that point. When the separatist parties, the separatist Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds, went back and became the central government in Iraq, they went back with this idea of partitioning Iraq, right? They said, let's partition Iraq into, we don't want this Iraq to continue being one country. Let's have a Kurdistan and a Sunnistan and a Shiastan and a Christianistan, you know? Now, people like myself said, those people are crazy. They're crazy. There is no way that you can do this. There are so much, Iraq is so mixed, you know? There are millions of people who are not Shiites who live in the south. Millions of people who are not Sunnis, who live in the middle, and hundreds of thousands of not Kurds, who live in the north, and vice versa. Now, their militias, the militias of these four parties, took care of that obstacle, the obstacle of how Iraq is overlapped and how people live in the same places. So they did indeed create a place where Iraq has a de facto partitioning. Millions of people were kicked out of their homes, you know. As you say, there was violence, there were mosques that were attacked, there were people that were attacked and threatened. Now, all of this to reach to a point where they can say, you see, now our idea of partitioning and ending the central government is easier to implement, you know. Like, imagine if someone comes to the U.S. and says, let's create a South that's exclusively African-American, and the North that's exclusively white, and West that's exclusively Jewish, and Southwest that's exclusively Mexican or Latino. Now, if people will say, well, you know, it's more mixed. Now, of course, the U.S. is way more segregated than Iraq, but it's still more mixed than these lines, right? Now, if in 5 years we had attacks happening in these regions that kicked all non-blacks from the south, you know, big migration, all non-whites from the north, and created this de facto partitioning, that would be easier for those separatists to say, okay, now we can do it, right? So I think what has been happening in Iraq in the last few years was more of a systematic campaign of ethnic and sectarian cleansing by militias, not by people, by militias, who want to partition the country and destroy the central government. Now, these militias have names and have faces, and they were trained and protected by the U.S. Government. Like, the way that Iraqis view the U.S. training of their forces is very similar to how Latin Americans view the School of the Americas and the U.S. role in training assassins who go back home. Yeah, you know, to go back home and kill their own people. So it's a very bloody long history of the last 6 years of U.S. interfering, supporting ethnic and sectarian militias to kill their own people, to destroy the central government. This is what has been happening. Now, if Iraqis were left alone, these things will reverse. They will fix it by themselves. Our role there as American forces, we're taking the side of this minority of sectarian militias against what the will of the majority of Iraqis want. Now, let me give you a public opinion poll just to show you how failed of a policy is this ethnic and sectarian cleansing and how imposed on the public it is. Last year, they asked Iraqis who are now living in the newly so-called Sunni neighborhoods and so-called Shiite neighborhoods. Now, for the first time since the creation of Baghdad, we have a neighborhood called a Sunni neighborhood and a neighborhood called a Shiite neighborhood because of the ethnic and sectarian cleansing that happened under the U.S. occupation. They asked people in these neighborhoods that after, of course, the sectarian cleansing finished, the U.S. Army built concrete walls around these neighborhoods to make the sectarian and ethnic cleansing hold, you know, so that people won't go back to their first neighborhood. So they asked Iraqis in these Sunni and Shiite neighborhoods, do you like the current situation of being sectarianly and ethnically divided, or do you want to go back to your original neighborhoods if the falls were removed? 98% said that they want to go back to their original neighborhoods. So I mean, imagine how much public resistance there is to this idea of sectarian divisions. So the idea was introduced to Iraq completely in 2003. I mean, I personally think it's just yet another classic example of divide and conquer. You know, how can the U.S. Control Iraq and destroy the society by just putting these fake divisions among people? Now, there's one thing that I want to mention just to show you how these divisions did not exist before 2003, because now the story, the revisionist history that is being told, is that the former Iraqi government was a Sunni government oppressing Shiites, and therefore these divisions existed all along. The thing that I want to mention is the 55 deck of cards that were printed by the State Department and Pentagon after the fall of Baghdad, the ones that had the 55 most wanted Iraqis, you know, the 55, I think. Yeah, whatever, like the top most wanted Iraqis who were running the political part of the government. Now, the information that was not mentioned by the State Department and Pentagon is that out of the 55, 36 were Shiites. So, I mean, if it's a really Sunni-led regime, why would they put 70% of their leadership from Shiites? You know, this is like saying the KKK has 70% of their leadership from African Americans. Yeah, that makes no sense, right? It's funny, because the KKK is indeed a race-based oppressive organization, but the former Iraqi government was a secular dictatorship. It was indeed a dictatorship, an oppressive regime, but was secular. It did not pick Iraqis based on their sect, because they're Sunnis. You know, the two vice presidents were a Christian and a Kurd who's a Shiite. You know, I mean, that sounds like a very inclusive and nice government, you know. Well, it's not. It's because it was a political dictatorship, and all of these people were chosen because of random selection. They just happened to be Christian, or happened to be Sunni, or happened to be Shiite. So these things never existed before. I don't think they will exist after. Now, from our point of view, we can't help Iraqis interpret, understand their own religion. You know, they speak Arabic better than us. They understand their religion more. We can't help them reconcile between Sunnis and Shiites. You know, we can't. This is not our role. We don't have the capacity to do these things. They have capacity to do these things, you know. People who have been living together in the same neighborhoods and intermarrying and eating the same food and speaking the same language, you know, they know how to do it by themselves. You know, me personally, I'm half Sunni and half Shiite. You know, my father is a Sunni and my mother is a Shiite. And many of my friends and family are Sunnis and Shiites, live in the same neighborhoods. They look exactly the same. We have the same last names because the big tribes have both Sunni and Shiite branches. We eat the same food. We have the same accents. You know, you can't tell that someone is a Sunni or a Shiite. These things are not divisions like they are, portrayed in the media. These things never existed in Iraq. There are sectarian divisions between Sunnis and Shiites, or Sunnis and Sunnis, in other Islamic countries around the world. You know, I see that there are some divisions, and there is such a thing as Sunnis living alone and Shiites living alone, having different last names and different cultures. It happens. Look at Lebanon, for example. You know, look at there are a couple of other countries. The same way that there are fights among Catholics and Protestants in other nations around the world. But Iraq has been an exception to these sectarian divisions or religious divisions all along. So, I mean, there is nothing that we can do to help Iraqis other than getting out of Iraq.
You say there's nothing we can do. Don't you think some massive efforts on education through beginning pamphlets and then books on the origins of religion can mollify extremist views that would lead to violence?
That's true. That's an excellent idea. But you do it in your neighborhood, and let Iraqis do it in their neighborhood, you know? Let's fight extremism in the U.S., and let Iraqis fight extremism in their own country. We don't have enough capacity. You know, Americans cannot go to Iraq and fight extremism by teaching Iraqis what the origins of their own religion is. You know, it can't happen. And Iraqis cannot come here to the U.S. to teach us here what Christianity or what, you know, being an American is, and being Christian doesn't mean that, you know, we should do this or do that, because we know more things about being American than them being American, right? I mean, imagine if there was an Iraqi grant to come to the U.S. and teach Americans about their constitution. Well, I think we need it, but I will actually, you know, stop against it, you know? I stop against it. I was like, why are you wasting your money? And it's none of your business how Americans will view their constitution. We have people here who are worried about their constitution, taxpayers who are here. You know, myself now, I'm putting my taxpayer hat here. I came to the U.S. I became part of this, you know, society. I read this constitution, and I'm worried about it, and I want to fix it, right? When I'm in Iraq, I'm worried about that, and I'm fixing it. Now, I completely understand that what you're saying comes from good intentions. But my point is that the same brilliant ideas that you come out with for Iraq, there are 10 Iraqis who are thinking about the same brilliant ideas for their neighborhood. You know, they are as worried about their country a little bit more, you know, than you are, because it's their street and the bombs are killing them. They are worried about this. And they are worried about extremism the same way that you are worried a little bit more. So that's why I think we have no role in going to Baghdad or to Afghanistan to tell people, you know what, these are the true instructions of Muhammad. And we think that these crazy extremists, Al-Qaeda, do not represent your religion. Who are we to do this, you know? Like, what's the difference between going all the way to tell Iraqis to understand their religion in that way, or, you know, going all the way to bomb them, you know? Like, there is no big difference between interfering in other people's cultures. People don't like it very much. I mean, let me take one last comment from you and take something from other people.
I'm speaking from home experience. Like, Baptists have killed Baptists. Well, there was a big meeting in Kansas City and a shootout.
Yeah.
And it's not to mention between Catholics and Protestants.
Yeah.
And I think liberation literally comes from an exposure to the delicate, very human origins of religions, in that they are frail and do not address modern problems. And
that's true. Now, this is like, for example, this is a great idea to bring, for example, Iraqis who are working on local reconciliation to visit Seattle and learn from the American experience. Go to Ireland and learn from the Irish experience, and go to South Africa and learn from the Southern African or South African experience. Right? There are so many great experiences around the world in how religious or political reconciliations happen. Now, what's happening in Iraq is, number one, not a religious war. People are not fighting because they are Sunnis or Shiites. So there is a difference between what's happening in Baghdad and the Protestants killing each other because of something, or Catholics. Right? There are different contexts there. But there are many things to learn from other experiences, and I'm all for learning from other cultures, whether it's Americans learning from Iraqis how they've been running their country for 7,000 years, or Iraqis learning from Americans how they dealt with some religious problems within the last 400 or 500 years. These things are excellent, and we should work on these cultural exchanges. But there is a difference between thinking about our role here. Our role is not to go tell Iraqis how to reconcile. This is not our role. They know, believe me, they know how to reconcile. They have better people, more qualified to reconcile them inside Iraq, more than people who we can send here. So our role is more about getting out of Iraqis' way and letting them do whatever they want to do, how to reconcile their country and running.
As a follow-on comment to what you've been saying, I think there's something that we as Americans should be worried about in that regard. I just heard it in the last section of Democracy Now! This week, which is the American military going and the chief proselytizing, the chief chaplain in Afghanistan said, the Green Berets are going after the enemy. We're going to go for our men for Christ. And they're passing out Bibles in Pashtun and other local languages. And that's, of course, in violation of our constitution and military laws. And we ought to be very concerned about that.
That's true.
I did want to say thank you so much. On the way down here, I stopped at every bus stop to tell the people who I'm going to hear and how important it is that we revisit this myth we have that Sunnis and Shiites have been at war for centuries. It's not true. I did want to ask a question. If you have a better understanding you can give us in terms of who may be fueling sectarian warfare.
Yeah.
I went and checked September of 2005. There was a report in the Washington Post, I read, of two British soldiers dressed in Arab garb with explosives in their car that were captured by the, I suppose, the Iraqi police in Basra and put in jail. And the British sent a tank to free them. What do you imagine those two British soldiers might be doing?
Yeah.
Did
everyone hear the question? There are two things when I talk about the U.S. role in agitating or creating sectarian differences or attempting to create sectarian and religious differences during the last 6 years. Now, one of them, of course, will be the secret operations that the incident that you mentioned is one of the most documented ones in Basra. I am positive that they've been doing something, you know, to agitate agitate civil conflict, right? Because that's the cheapest way to kill people and to destroy a nation, to let people fight among each other, to put a bomb in front of an, you know, African-American church one day, and then a bomb in front of a white church another day, and let people kill each other in Mississippi. Is cheaper than bombing their homes and getting international response to what would happen. Now, in Iraq, the plans to agitate sectarian conflict did not work very well. Until now, 5 or 6 years after, the Iraqi public are still against sectarian divisions. They still think that they are Iraqi first before they are Sunni or Shiite, and they still think that all of these divisions were inserted or introduced to Iraq by foreigners after 2003. Now, there are many other smaller cases that are documented about Chelebi, for example, and the three Iraqi fighters who went with him, who were trained by the U.S., participating in some of these sectarian killings and agitating civic unrest, or assassinating people who can build a strong, prosperous Iraq. Yesterday there was a report on one of the Iraqi newspapers showing that in the last 6 years, 419, or almost 420, Iraqi professors were assassinated. And by assassinated, I don't mean like they were walking down the street and a car bomb went off and killed them with other people. No, they were picked out and assassinated. Imagine how like bad intended people who go all the way to Iraq to kill professors. It's not sectarian. This is not religious. It's more about destroying Iraq as a nation, as peoples, as resources that can become a regional power and run itself by itself, right? Of course, other hundreds of professors run away, whatever. So the secret operations, they are maybe, I don't know, every day, every week. I will be assuming, there are no documented cases that show us that there is a daily secret operation. But there are documented information about how the U.S. introduced sectarian divisions to Iraq. When Paul Bremer went to Iraq, he created the first governing council in Iraq's history where people were selected based on their sect or religious background. The governing council that was created in 2003 by Paul Bremer picked Iraqis based on their sect or ethnicity, not based on their capability or capacity. That's the first time. There is no precedent before that for someone to say, come participate in running the country because you're a Sunni or because you're a Shiite. So three Shiites, two Sunnis, one Christian, like these type of things. Never happened before. And I don't think it will ever happen after the U.S. occupation. The U.S. Senate passed a sense of the Senate law, a resolution, a couple of years ago that was co-sponsored by Biden and Brownback. 74 of the senators voted yes on a sense of the Senate resolution supporting partitioning Iraq, creating, you know, this Sunni and Shiite and Kurdish, right? And many, of course, of the propaganda, the U.S. propaganda that was justifying and pushing towards partitioning Iraq, and the U.S. supporting actively for the last 6 years the four parties with the four militias that did the dirty work. The U.S. did support them politically, choose them to become the executive branch, brought their militias and gave their militias weapons to go in the streets and kill others and ethnically and sectarianly cleanse. The U.S. Army built walls around the ethnically cleansed and sectarianly cleansed neighborhoods after they were sectarianly cleansed. So after the militias did the dirty work and kicked out all Sunnis and all Shiites and put them in these neighborhoods, the U.S. Army went and put the icing on the cake, the topping. They put a small concrete wall to prevent anyone from going back to their original neighborhood and gave everyone an ID card to just come to this neighborhood, not go to that one. So the U.S. role is not a conspiracy. We don't really need to, go track whether it's true or not true that the U.S. secret operations did put some bombs or didn't put some bombs. Maybe down history we will go back and we will find some more documented cases. A few months ago, I actually saw someone from a resistance group called the Islamic Army shot down a Blackwater helicopter and found a digital camera in it. And the Blackwater helicopter was going around this building and they were taking pictures of it, and the building blew up. So that's there's a question mark about that. Like, why is the Blackwater helicopter going around the building and then the building blowing up? Are these State Department contractors a part of the secret, Black Ops, secret operations or not? There are so many questions to be answered, but we have so many facts now to indicate that the U.S. role was not a uniter role, was not a convener of reconciliation and peace. It was a divider role, a divider that played divide and conquer, took sides, supported some Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds with their separatist and sectarian agendas against the rest of the population, a role that wanted to destroy the central government and keep Iraq a weak country that will want the U.S. to stay there indefinitely to interfere. These are the facts on the ground, and I hope that these facts will convince us that the U.S. role has been extremely negative in the last 6 years, and we have no role to play now. We have no role to play more than getting out first, and then maybe we can teach Iraqis a lot of stuff. If they wanted to learn, if Iraqis asked, how did you deal with your religious tensions in your country? Well, we can teach them. If the Iraqis asked, how did you deal with your political tensions in your country, right? After the American Civil War, there were political tensions during and after it, right, between white people against other white people. That wasn't racial, right? It was more political. How did we deal with that? How would we deal with other things? If we have things to teach, we will teach. If we don't, we'll maybe say we don't. You should go to other nations. Maybe I'll take one last question or two last questions. But I mean, the short answer is horrible. I think this is how I will evaluate the position of women. Actually, two of my brothers and my mother, we have blogs. We write our personal diaries online. And last year we printed our first year of diaries under the occupation in a book that you can buy on Amazon.com. If you write my name or if you write my name on Amazon.com, it shows up. It's called the Iraq War Blog. Most of the book is my mother's diaries from the days of the occupation. And I mean, it's really sad to see how Iraq turned from one of the countries in the region with a very vibrant and strong women rights movement to now a situation where, you know, women have no rights. Men don't have no rights now. Neither men nor women have any rights in Iraq. And the destruction of the women rights that happened under the occupation is unbelievable. People like my mother, for example, she comes from a poor family, and she studied in the Iraqi free education system and became an engineer, a civic engineer. And she met my dad, and she was a hardcore, 70s feminist who, gave hell to any man who wanted to give her his seat in the bus because men and women are equal. Well, now she can't leave the house alone. She can't go to our family's business. She can't leave the house. She was attacked a couple of times by gangs, and she can't. I mean, she has no rights, no choices, no right. So, I mean, these are the problems, is that sometimes the U.S. government does bring up some legitimate causes. Like, for example, now they're saying Iranian women are oppressed. Well, I mean, it's true. In many cases, Iranian women are oppressed inside Iran. There is, a system of oppression that puts Iranian women under so much limitations on how they can look or how they can act or whatever. Now, that's a legitimate cause. But when the U.S. government uses that legitimate cause, they don't use it to really liberate Iranian women. They use it to advance an illegitimate agenda. And the same thing happened with Iraq. They said, let's go to Iraq to liberate Iraqis. It doesn't mean that Iraqis did not need liberation. They did need liberation. But they didn't need someone to come 10,000 miles away with a tank to liberate them. They wanted to do that by themselves, So that's the problem. There are a lot of things that are unjust and need to be fixed around the world. But we have no business going to Iran to bomb them and liberate their women, or to Iraq to bomb them and liberate them from their president. They know how to do it by themselves.
Do you see any internal movement on
the other
side? Those who are trying to
repress them? Right, not now. I mean, I don't think there will be any healthy women movements under the current occupation. I don't think this is possible, actually. But in the future, I'm full of hope that we will have a healthy women movement that will get some of the women rights that were lost in the last 10 years and build on that, to try to get to a place where Iraqi women live the life that they choose for themselves rather than someone else chooses it for them. I'll take my last question.
Go ahead.
You've talked about how the Iraqis, feel about the troops. And if I remember correctly, you said there may be equal numbers of contractors.
Yeah, a little bit more.
How do they feel about the contractors?
It depends. Now,
do you feel like there's any difference, or is it American and American, you're all a bunch of invaders?
I think Iraqis don't like any foreigners to be in their land to occupy it, whether they're Americans or, Buddhists from Tibet. They don't like someone to come to their land as an invader. Now, they don't hate Americans per se. They hate Americans to be in their land, right? Or they hate Brits to be in their land. Most of the U.S. contractors are not security contractors. Most of them are, they cook and they clean the camp and they put gas in the truck and, these are contractors. And there are some security contractors, like the ones that you're thinking about, which are the ones that go around streets. I think the general atmosphere in Iraq, it doesn't really distinguish that much between what people's outfits or what they call themselves combat troops and combat troops. It's more about ending any form of foreign intervention in Iraq, whether it's Iranian or American or other types. So they're viewed as negatively, if not more, I guess, these security type, contractor types, because they have no limitation. They go around neighborhoods shooting civilians with no limitation, they don't fall under Iraqi laws or anything. So I think when people speak about ending the occupation, they mean ending the occupation by all of its forms, not keeping any type of it. Well, thank you, everyone, for coming. I really appreciate your time. Thanks a lot.